before jumping on the podcast today, I was thinking how we met, and we met over the pandemic. You reached out to me, and I have no clue how you found me. How did we connect?
How did I find you? I think I found you on Instagram, and I was looking at, trainers, or I can't remember how that went, but I remember seeing you on Instagram, and I remember you had some openings. I think you were giving a course, and you had some one-on-one openings, and I thought, let me give it a shot. He probably doesn't take clients like me, and I just thought I would give it a try and reach out to you, and here we are.
Yeah, which is so crazy. And the truth is, I had never had a client like you. He was a producer and working in the entertainment business and at your level. So for me, it was exciting and a cool challenge. And as we got to know each other, I realized, wow, there's a lot of layers to you. But in order for me to today understand who you are a little bit more, I want you to kind of take me back to the early days of Helen as a kid. Who is Helen, and where does she come from?
Well, as a kid, let's see. I'm a middle child. We're all 6 years apart. I have an older sister, and she was born in Bolivia, but I was born in New York. I was the first one in my family to be born in the United States. And both of my parents are from Bolivia. And we lived in early times. We lived in Jamaica, Queens, and it was very, it was a very different place than where we live now. But it was great. We had a really nice, nice time together. We were very, very tight because it was just us. And then we moved to a small area in Long Island by the beach, and it was very pretty. I think I was about, 4 at that time. And so that's actually around 4 was when I knew that I wanted to also work in entertainment. So it was sort of those two things happened at the same time. And and so that's kind of where I started to feel like I wanted to somehow work in the movies or in TV. Those were the early days.
That's interesting. I'm also a middle child, and there is a theory that middle children they want attention, and they're kind of like grasping. I don't know if that's true for you, but my perspective is that people who are in the entertainment business don't mind being seen, or at least want to be in the mix of creating something that becomes seen. Is that true for you or not, because you're somebody who works more behind the scenes?
I was at very young, I was involved in plays, and I was pretty outgoing up to a point, I would say up until I was probably about 6. So there were 2 years like there where I was really outgoing. And but then things kind of changed in school. I was bullied a lot, and so I became very, very, very shy and very quiet. That was very bad. But then I ended up going to a different high school, and I was just talking about it with a friend of mine over the weekend, and that high school actually helped me because it was a place where I felt like I wasn't being bullied constantly. And then I got back into plays, and I was always in sports, like throughout the entire time growing up. I played every sport I possibly could, but I really didn't get back into theater, high school theater, until I switched schools. Yeah, I went to a pretty nice Quaker school where the kids were a little bit more open-minded. and the teachers weren't as punishing, so it was actually much better for me. And let's see. Yeah, I mean, I think that as a kid, I don't know if I wanted attention, but I definitely was independent because we're 6 years apart. And so my brother came along when I was six, and I sort of, you know, just kind of did stuff on my own a lot. played outside. It was a different time. So I'd be in the woods or running around outside by myself and enjoying that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was at the time where you would just be out until, the street lights came on. Then it was time to go home for dinner or at least get to bed or something.
Yeah, we didn't really have like a neighborhood where, where we ended up living, which is where my parents live now. We just had, it was like woods, it was the beach and woods. And so I would be outside playing, doing whatever. And a lot of times,
you didn't even have street lights. You just had the sunlight.
Pretty much. I mean, there were some street lights, but you wouldn't want to play, on our street because it was like a two-lane road, and then there was the beach, and so it was, you don't want to play on that street. It wasn't really a neighborhood. I would have to, on Halloween, I remember I would go to other people's neighborhoods to trick or treat and stuff. So it was a little different, very different from Jamaica, from Queens. I have to say, it was like super different from that. But I was pretty independent, I think. But in the back of my mind, I knew that I wanted to work in entertainment somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So, maybe
so that was
from...
that was when the seed was planted when you were mm-hmm. a kid and you started getting into plays. And then if you fast forward, what was the first moment where you transitioned into the entertainment industry as a professional? Take me through that.
That was in 96. And that was when I was visiting LA and I ran into a woman. She was a senior VP at Universal. And I didn't run into her. Actually, I arranged to have lunch with her. I'd met her previously in New York through a friend that I was going to Parsons with. And so we had lunch, and on the spot, she just offered me to production manage a direct-to-video feature that was being made at Universal. And so we talked about it over lunch. And by the end of lunch, I just said, when do you need me? And she said, 3 weeks. And I said, okay. I just said yes. I mean, I was saying yes to everything at that point. It was like anything that I could do because I didn't know anybody in the entertainment business. I didn't know anybody in any of the studios or even working in commercials in New York. I had no way in. And the only thing that I knew was, I needed to say yes to a lot of different things. I ended up volunteering on, my sister had friends who were at NYU and they were doing their student films. And so I ended up, helping them out. If I saw something at the mayor's office pop up that I could do, pull cable down the street during a parade or, something just to help out. Like they were shooting Morgan Fairchild at the plaza. So could I help out and PA on that? And I did, but I really didn't know what I was doing. But it definitely was just, it was a time when I was saying yes to a lot of things, hopefully leading me into something. And so that one thing, that saying yes to my friend who introduced me to this woman for brunch, led to me calling her up when I was in LA.
Wow.
And yeah.
That's interesting. And at that time in New York, you were doing commercial real estate. And I know you were designing your own jewelry. Did the jewelry start in New York and you tried to bring it with you to LA, or how did jewelry play a part in getting you into the industry by proxy, maybe, or just through your network?
The jewelry started when I was in New York. It was just an outlet, and it was something that I did for myself at first, and then I started to, you know, show it at stores and friends, and they started ordering. And then the jewelry stores that I was selling to in New York, they said, well, one of them had, it was Billy Martin's. They had a place on Sunset Plaza in LA, and they said, why don't you take it to Sunset Plaza, you know, show it to them. And so I did, and that was great, but it was almost like a hobby and an outlet more than something that I thought was going to keep me going for the long run. And then the woman who I had met, her name is Anne, the woman who I had met, she said, oh, I know all the buyers in LA, you know, Fred Siegel and everything. And when you're in LA, bring your jewelry and, you know, and so I did. And over the lunch, I brought my jewelry, but she didn't want to see the jewelry. She never asked to see it. And instead she pulled out a, you know, an Excel sheet. It had a schedule on it. And she said, you know, this is the project that I'm thinking of you for.
And what project was that?
That was Hercules and Cena, the battle for Mount Olympus.
My friends, I want to interrupt this podcast just for 30 seconds to say that if you made it this far, and up until this point, you haven't taken the time to either subscribe to the podcast or follow it on whatever platform you're listening on, to please do so. And if you have been enjoying this episode and previous episodes leading up to this one, to please go and rate and review. It helps a ton, and it only allows me to do a better job at producing these episodes for you and potentially getting more guests that can, yeah, provide some amazing insight. So with that being said, thank you so much, and back to the episode.
Nice. And you go into that job knowing really nothing.
No, I didn't know anything.
Production, other than just having done like some PA stuff on student films.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know anything about animation, period. Like, I really didn't. I wish that I had, because it was a big responsibility, and I felt so, I don't know, I felt very, I would say very nervous in a way. And I don't know if it's nervous. I just felt very responsible, and I didn't want to disappoint people. And I knew that everybody else was working really hard. It's also embarrassing when everybody else is such a pro. I mean, these are people that worked on, you know, big shows prior. And I, you know, I didn't. I hadn't had that experience. And so I felt like I had a lot to learn and a lot to catch up on. So when people would go home at night, I would stay in the studio as late as I possibly could. And I was just trying to figure out stuff on my own.
Mm.
And at that
and
point...
What position did you take there? What was the role?
That was... I was production manager. And so on that movie, it was a direct video feature, but on that one, so the budget wasn't gigantic, and I was right under her as the production manager. So there wasn't another person other than her to go to. And she was primarily like overseeing, you know, the show artistically. So I didn't really have a person that I could particularly go to. That was a little hard.
So why do you think she decided to hire somebody with little to no experience like yourself?
I have no idea.
My guess is that if there's somebody hustling their jewelry, they're probably thinking, okay, this person gets shit done. Mm. And if they called me, they also have initiative. Could that be it, or am I just now projecting my positive outlook on the world?
You know, I don't know. I sometimes I wonder that. Like, she took a big risk, but I think also, you know, maybe she thought that it was more of a chemistry thing, and she thought I would get along with the crew, as opposed to, okay, she's going to, you know, she's going to know everything from day one, you know, maybe she thought there was an allowance there. Like, if she'll get along with the team, then, you know, we can deal with the you know, the numbers and the, you know, the production part in a different way. There was somebody there who was a, he was a studio production manager, and he was somebody that initially I thought I was going to be looking towards for guidance. Unfortunately, he ended up leaving the studio because at that time, Universal was kind of going through a lot of changes. And so the woman who hired me, Anne, ended up leaving and before the show ended. And the same thing happened with Alex, and he ended up leaving as well. So, you know, in a way, I was sort of figuring it out on my own towards the end part of the show. But yeah, I think that had I known better at that point, I would have sought out a mentor.
Did the job pay well?
Well, at that time, you know, for me, it paid well because it was my first time working in animation. And so, yeah, I mean, compared to volunteering on student films and volunteering at, you know, the IFM and, you know, a lot of volunteer work that I was doing, did it pay as well as commercial real estate? No. But was it something that I could see growing in? Yeah, for sure.
That's very cool. So you bring this project to a close, you wrap it up. By the time you end that project, did you already have something else lined up, or were you just now standing there looking for the next thing? What was that like, and how did you transition, and what did you find next?
Yeah, I was looking for the next thing, and I ended up, I was looking for the next thing, and I went with an artist friend to meet with somebody at Sony. And at that time, Sony had like a pretty big TV department where they were doing a lot of TV series. And I went to meet the head of production with him, and I got a job after that meeting.
So how do you prepare for something like that? Okay, so if I imagine myself in your shoes, do you just say, I just worked on this production, this is my experience, and that's it? Or is it, how do you walk into a meeting like that? What are you thinking?
I do remember going in with him, being introduced, and I just, you know, I think I introduced myself and I said that he and I had worked together. They had a conversation. I think he might have mentioned that I was, you know, looking for something, looking for my next job. And I had told her that I wanted to work in TV. I wanted to try episodic. I wanted to try television. Little did I know at that point that what I probably was doing different. It wasn't normal to do that. I think if you start off in sort of a feature role, you try to stay with feature. You try to continue on that path. I didn't know that at that point. You know, I didn't know that it was going to be, if I went into television, that for a while I was going to be working in television, and it would take a while to get me back into working in features. So, but I gave it a shot, and I did 3 shows at Sony at that time. So I worked on Jumanji, and I worked on Big Guy and Rusty the Boy Robot, and I worked on Harold and the Purple Crayon.
Super cool. And now you're taking on these new jobs, and your resume, so to speak, is building. At this time, you still don't have a mentor. You're just kind of learning this trial by fire type thing. How how do you navigate that, for one? And two, what is the moment where you realize that you're doing it? Oh, yeah, I'm in it. This is what I do now.
I think I realized it at Sony, because Once I realized it when I was at Sony, probably on Harold and the Purple Crayon. I think that's when I really realized, like, this is what I'm going to, you know, continue on for the long term. It's not just something that I want to do and give it a shot. You know, it was more like, okay, I have to figure out how to get to the next thing that I really want to work on that would be fun, that I could, you know, enjoy, and that would be different. And I remember, that was the time when I left. I didn't finish Harold and the Purple Crayon. I left and I went to line produce SpongeBob, and that was at Nickelodeon. And so I think that was when I realized this is really, you know, this is something that I really, really want to do. I really love working with, you know, I love working with artists, but I also love the, I don't know, it's just sort of a very collaborative, you know, team environment. And that's when I felt like, this was going to be it. Now, during that time also, 9/11 happened. And so we were finishing up the third season of SpongeBob. I mean, third season. I don't even know what season we're on now. 15? I have no idea.
How are you guys doing? Third?
But that was, I don't know, more. But that was the third season. And so there was a pause because they were going to go and make a movie. And they needed to, you know, take pause, write the script, and go and produce it. And at that point, 9/11 happened, and I decided that's when I wanted to move back to New York. But I didn't have a job. And so I thought, there's really very limited animation in New York. I'm not really sure what I'm going to do. But I knew I just wanted to be back. And so I just moved back and took a chance. And then I started working on a game for Scholastic, which at that time it was like a CD-ROM game. And it was involving all the Nickelodeon characters. So it was SpongeBob and Rugrats and Fairly Odd Parents. And you could, you know, mash up the characters and create your own cartoon. So I worked on that at Scholastic, but it was very, very, very low pay. And but I wanted to do it. I just thought, you know, this is going to lead somewhere, but I didn't even know where. It was just something to keep me in New York for a bit. And then they called me up and they asked me if I would produce a show for them, Maya and Miguel. And that was for PBS. And I said, well, actually, I'm working for you already. And I don't think that the person who called me quite knew that. It was a different sort of division anyway. So that was fine. So I ended up going and producing that. And that was really interesting because I'd never really pulled together a team or a show. And particularly in New York, that was another thing. Like, we were right in Soho, in the middle of Soho, and it was really fun. And a few people from LA came and worked on it. Not everybody, you know, it's just a couple of people who were willing to take a chance and come out here. So that was really nice. Then I ended up getting a phone call from Henry Selick, just asking if I would consider maybe going to Portland and working with a few people there who were starting up an animation studio. It used to be Vinton. At that time, it was called Vinton. I think that was in April of 2004. And then by July, I had moved there and it was rebranded as Leica.
That's so cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's crazy. I feel like I'm getting like a history lesson here, but let's pull all the way back to Sony again. So Sony, you produce three shows. You don't finish the third show. You move on to Nickelodeon, but it's in that transition where you realize, oh yeah, this is what I want to do. producer at the moment is my role. There's different expressions of that. I'm curious, what do you learn at Sony and how does that carry over to Nickelodeon? What's the big takeaway from working with Sony?
That I could, I mean, it, with each job, I think I just learned how far I could stretch myself. And at Sony, I wasn't necessarily called a producer. I was an associate producer. And
what's the difference?
Yeah, it's funny. I think it just, I almost want to say it's a rate difference. It's a bit of an experience difference, and different studios call people different things. Sony, they called us associate producers instead of line producers. And when I went over to Nickelodeon, I became a line producer, and I also, my rate increased as well, which was very nice. So I think, yeah, I mean, that transition was really, it actually helped me a lot, because I know it helped my confidence a lot, because I know that at that point I felt like, well, this is the third show I'm doing here and I really would like a bit of an increase. And I learned how to ask for that and at the same time be very straightforward about it. And then this opportunity to work on SpongeBob came up. And I felt like I had asked for, it's so hard to talk about even. I had asked for maybe a bump up for, you know, what I was doing at Sony, and that didn't come through. And I understood that, you know, budgets need to be adhered to. And I was ready for a change, you know. I was ready to sort of take a chance on a different type of show. Nickelodeon was definitely a different type of studio. You know, they were really different from what I was used to at Sony. And yeah, they had someone, it was like, they were just, I don't know. It was just like, it felt like everything was catered towards having fun and enjoying yourself at the studio while you were at work. You know?
Yeah, so Sony sounds like Japanese level serious. Nickelodeon sounds like it's just like a party. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, Sony was different because it was sort of, we worked in we weren't working, you know, on the lot, and it was TV. It wasn't like Sony. I mean, Sony Feature now is, you know, stupendous. It's like amazing. And I think their series work is also going to be very good. But I think at that time it was very different. You know, it was like 1999, you know, or something like that. So things were a little bit different then. But this, you know, going to Nickelodeon definitely was fun. Everything was so colorful. That's all I remember, was walking in that studio. There was a basketball court. Everything was super colorful. There were all the splats everywhere. And there was always, you know, some fun activity happening. They had their own record studio in the building, which was, you know, great.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really definitely a different place for me to work. And
yeah.
The team was also very different. It was all board driven. It wasn't script driven. So
what does that mean?
Well, it wasn't, you didn't get a script to start working on. So the board artists would essentially be, you know, the directors would essentially be the writers. Board artists would really be the writers. They started with a springboard, an idea, and then, you know, the board artists would, you know, make it blossom, and they would come up with the gags and the script and, you know, the dialogue. And so it was a little bit different than getting a script from a writer or a story editor.
Right. Yeah, that makes total sense. So I really like this idea of you being at Sony and realizing, okay, I have proven myself in this field through this role. I'm ready to level up. And you're faced with this moment where you have to ask for what you need. You do that, you get rejected, you get the opportunity to transition into a new working environment. And there now you get to level up. It's completely different. And you get to work on a legendary project like SpongeBob. Were you there for episode one or no? When did you come in?
I came in season 2 and 3. Yeah, season 2 and 3. Season 1 was done. And that line producer went over to Cartoon Network at the time. And then then they had an opening. And that's when I went over.
Mm-hmm. Did you realize at the time working on SpongeBob how big of a project that was? I mean, this brand, it's insane. No. So you didn't realize?
Well, I didn't, for sure. I thought it was really, I didn't. I thought it was so cute and so funny. And I really, I really liked the people working on it. I thought it was so kind of, it was just like very freeing. It was just like a very free environment, but also very, very meticulous in every way. From the models to, there were very few consumer products, but at that point, the creator was Steve. He was very concerned about everything looking exactly how he wanted. He wanted to stay true to the characters that he had created. Mm-hmm. I just remember it was very freeing, but at the same time, it was also very, very disciplined in a way, but in a good way.
Were you close to Steven, or did you get to work with him? He passed away, right, in 2000?
Yeah, he passed away. 18. I want to say it was 16. I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly the date. I wish I had worked with him longer, but they went on to make the movie and everything, and I left, and I went, that's when I went back to New York, so I didn't really stay in touch with him that much. I had seen him sort of recently, which was really nice, but we worked together, so I did work closely with him. His office was right next to mine, and we would see each other all the time, and I had to interact with him all the time because I was the line producer of the show. So he was a wonderful person.
Mm-hmm.
He really was. And sorely, sorely missed, I think, by many people. He brought a lot of people together. I mean, that's the one thing he did do. He really knew how to surround himself. I look back on it and I'm like, wow, he really surrounded himself with some amazing, talented people. And what a show. And
I mean, iconic in the space for sure, and something that now generations are familiar with. It's very, very cool. And I believe that everybody is influenced and influences others. I'm wondering, how did your time at Nickelodeon and maybe interacting with somebody like Steven and team influence you before you decided to move back to New York?
I think that there was, I did have a big appreciation for the show itself. I really wanted to work on a movie at that point too. And so I was a little bit, I was a little bit torn. I kind of wished that I had been able to stay and maybe worked on that movie. But at the same time, I was like, if I'm not going to be able to work on this movie with everybody, then really, I should probably go back to New York, because that's something, there wasn't anything that I felt at that point that was really holding me to LA. And there was just something about, something about just not feeling like, I don't want to say there wasn't anything worth staying for in LA, but had I ended up working on that movie, I would have stayed. But because that didn't work out, I was you know, I knew I wanted to leave and just, you know, return to New York, especially at that time. What did I take away from it? My God, I mean, a lot. I think there's a way of working with people. It was just such a different way of working with people on that show than there was on when I was working at Sony. I think it was just a really different style. It was very loose. And the vision that, you know, Steve and Derek Dryman, the vision that the two of them had for the show, I think that sort of carried through, and it still carries through. I mean, I think that was the most important thing that I learned, was that when somebody has a really clear vision of what they want, it just makes it a lot easier for everybody else. Whereas if it's coming from, you know, different places, or, you know, when it's just harder when you're not working with somebody who's so invested in their creation, you know? It could be hard when somebody's really invested in their creation and they're sort of, you know, they only see it one way. That's not how it was on that show. It was very, I would say,
elaborate. Your vision?
I think, you know, just to have this really innocent, he was almost like this innocent character, and it made me think a lot about childhood, like fun, stupid things that you did as a kid. A lot of those things would come up in the shows, you know, taking foibles or embarrassing moments and incorporating that in the show. There's just a lot of, like, I think, freedom, even to the point of where, you know, I think Steve knew who he wanted to collaborate with musically. He was very clear on that. And he also let people do their jobs. I think that was a big takeaway that I, you know, in retrospect, I looked and saw that he really let everybody do exactly what they were really good at doing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty big. So once you decide to go back to New York and you're working on this video game, which, yeah, maybe was a job, but not necessarily the highlight of your production career. And you have had this amazing experience working on SpongeBob, and you transition into working with PBS. What was that like? Can you remember what was percolating for you at the time that has shaped you as who you are today?
With Maya and Miguel, I think that was probably the first time where I had to start the team from the ground up. So it wasn't sort of, you know, I wasn't hiring people that were already in a studio, that I wasn't inheriting sort of a team. Oops, sorry. I was actually starting a team from the ground up, and I wasn't, you know, coming in and inheriting a team that had already existed and having to sort of, you know, integrate into an already formed group of people. And so this was a little bit different, where I had to actually find the, you know, how are we going to work? Where are we going to work? What's appropriate office space for us? I mean, Scholastic had some buildings. They had two buildings, I think, three maybe. And, you know, where are we going to put the desks? Where are we going to put people? How big does the team have to be? Let's test the studios. Like, everything was pretty much from scratch, except for the writers. They already knew who they wanted to have as the writers. It was a little bit Yeah, it was a lot of, it was different. You know, I had to, that was the first time I really felt like, okay, this is, I have to, you know, pull this together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, which is really cool that you get the experience of mm-hmm. building it from, basically from the ground up and building the team. It's, that's a powerful experience. I'm curious, how do you get in there? Did they just seek you out, or did you seek this opportunity out?
There was a woman who called me, and I remember, I think she worked in, she was in post-production there, and she called me. I remember getting a call from her, and I just thought it was really funny. And I just said that I would, you know, I'd love to meet, and that was it. You know, that mm-hmm. was kind of it.
Yeah. So somebody calls and says, I'm calling from PBS, looking for you.
No, it wasn't PBS. It was actually Scholastic.
Okay, that was Scholastic.
Yeah,
okay.
It was Scholastic. So Scholastic was producing it for PBS.
I see. Okay, right. Very cool. So anyways, and that person didn't even know that you were working for Scholastic at the time, or what?
No, she didn't. I don't think she knew, because I remember telling her, it's going to be pretty easy for me to meet with you because I work here. And I said, you know, I'm helping out on a game. And yeah. So we met, and I, you know, the game, the people that were working on the game were really nice, but it just wasn't my, it wasn't the place where I felt, you know, like I was going to flourish necessarily. And in a way, I kind of thought, well, everything happens for a reason. You know, it was good that I was working on the game and I was right there. You know, it was an easy transition for me to start working on one of their shows.
So working on the game, that's something that you didn't really have to finish. Somebody else just took your place, or mm-hmm. how do you wrap that up to go and start this?
Well, I didn't have a high level job on the game, obviously. I mean, I hired the writer. In fact, the writer was somebody who I'd worked with on SpongeBob. You know, I worked with the game developer. I was really more of a, I think I was an associate producer on that, or I think associate producer. But it wasn't high level. There was a producer on it. There were people on it that really knew these games inside and out, and they had worked at Scholastic for many years. So my leaving, I don't think was a tremendous impact on them. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that at that point they were really, you know, we had already done the records with the actors. I mean, we kind of went down the road a ways with that game, so it wasn't like a huge void, I don't think.
Yeah, makes sense. And once you started working on this show for PBS, what role did you take on then?
That was producer.
Okay, yeah. So that was producer.
Yep.
And that was now you running things basically top to bottom,
mm-hmm.
it sounds like. A lot of responsibility. When do you get the call to potentially move to Oregon or Portland?
We had already been writing. We were well into writing the episodes. I think we had 26 episodes. And we were already shipping stuff overseas. So I think we were probably about a year and a half into it, maybe.
And then when you get the call from, you get it directly from Laika, or who calls you?
No, I got a call from Henry Selick. And
was he big at the time, or?
I mean, he was big in animation world, I guess, because he had, you know, directed Nightmare Before Christmas.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and he just was, yeah, he's one of those people that, but he's just one of those directors that I think people admire a lot. And so it was really strange when I got that call, but I was very, you know, excited. And I wasn't sure about moving to Portland, though. That was mm-hmm. the thing that I was kind of conflicted with. But I felt like I'm going to produce his short CG. He's doing a short CG film. Mm-hmm. And And I had actually said, you know, I had, at that point, I hadn't worked in CG. And I said, you know, I don't know CG, and you're probably calling the wrong person. And he said, no, I don't know CG either. So we'll learn together. And I thought, I'll never forget that he said that, because I was like, oh, wow, okay, that's one way to look at it, which is pretty cool. And so then I went to visit. That was April. I remember it was April. And I moved in July.
That's incredible. I mean, for those who are, you know, a fly on the wall right now, just kind of listening in on this conversation that we're having, I think there's a theme here that's very interesting, and it's that you simply learn by doing. And when somebody that has a caliber of in their work and expertise calls you and says, you know what, I'll just learn with you, I don't know anything about this either, I think that's an eye-opening moment, and it's very powerful to hear that. And it's empowering, because I think a lot of people, myself included, we're waiting to know something or feel like we're ready to be able to pull the trigger and do the next thing, or finally do the thing that we've always wanted to do. But it seems like things just happen, and they happen so that you can learn, meaning you're already ready type thing. It's cool.
I don't know, because it felt like I had felt when I was starting out at Universal, when I got to Leica, because I didn't know anything about CG. I never pretended that I did. It was more like, you know, I was there, I was learning, I was really trying to adjust to life in Portland, which is very different. The weather was very hard for me after, you know.
Yeah, that's horrible.
After the first year, it got to be a little rough. But what was tough was that, like, we had a whole R&D department, and they had a way of doing things. And then we had, you know, the production people, who the artists and the people that were going to be using all these tools and, you know, everything that R&D was creating. And so the trick was understanding what R&D was creating and sort of being able to, you know, bring it into the entertainment part of it, and the artist part of it, the artistic part of it. And it's hard, you know, to get those two groups together, I think, and get them sort of understanding each other, especially when you're learning yourself, you know. So that was a little tricky, but you know, I ended up staying there. I thought I was going to be there for 9 months, maybe a year, working on Henry Short. We finished the short, it went into some festivals, Henry went on to do Coraline, and I ended up developing an animated feature, a CG animated feature, and I did that for, I think it was another 3 years, and then it was shut down, and they decided to, you know, continue doing stop motion, and not doing, you know, a talking animal CG movie, which... It was a smart decision for them as far as what they wanted to do next and what they wanted to do at the studio. So, so the studio is, you know, as you know, people there, and it continues, and, you know, they've done some brilliant work. But I left after that movie. Yeah. After that movie got shut down, I was under a contract, so I stayed. And then once the movie shut down, that's when I decided to come back to LA, because at that point, animation had kind of dried up in LA. I mean, sorry, in New York. Mm-hmm. So there really wasn't much in New York for me to, you know, to try and hop onto. I moved back to LA, to the Sun, and then I started to work at Disney.
Okay. So before we get into Disney and this chapter, question about the difference between animation, CG, and stop motion. What's the difference when it comes to production? Is there a technical expertise that you need to have to produce better? Or this may sound like a very naive question, but I'm genuinely curious.
Well, I mean, peripherally, I know people who work in stop motion, but I don't know, you know, I don't have the resources that somebody who's worked in stop motion for many, many years has, you know, to pull together a team and also to really understand the intricacies of it. I understand it from, you know, further back, I would say, somebody who's not as, you know, in the weeds with it.
So higher level type production?
It's more of, I would say, it's not being done. Parts of it are being done in the computer, but there's a very practical aspect to it. There's a fabrication to, you know, that there's puppet fabrication. There's, you know, set fabrication. You're actually working with physical sets. Whereas in, you know, CG or 2D, everything is in the computer. So it's different, you know, the environment's different. The way you shoot it is obviously very different. The animators are different. I think a lot of animators can cross over, but it's different. I think maybe one of the things that does overlap probably is, you know, compositing at the end. I think that does overlap a bit with, you know, the way that you do CG or 2D. But it's a different, it's a different discipline.
Yeah.
It's really cool though. Like, I think it's just
stop motion, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, so stop cool. Motion is insane. I got to visit a studio and see how they were doing it, and it's like it's a set that's maybe 1/10 or maybe 1/10 of a size of a real human set. But it's all just happening there, and the amount of detail that comes into play just for one frame is absolutely insane. It takes forever to set up. It's unbelievable. I know now I'm going very technical on this, but I'm genuinely curious. And if you have the information, I would love to hear. When you got into animation, specifically SpongeBob, was that drawn on boards and then on paper, and you did the like flipping around of the little sheets like that?
Well, it was drawn on paper, and we had sheet timers as well, or animation directors. So they were the ones who, you know, I think we had four at the time, and they were really the ones who kind of directed the timing and the action of the characters. Like, they were the ones who would really spell it out on these exposure sheets that would get sent overseas. We had physical boards, physicals. We shipped boxes, now that I think about it. Yeah, we were still shipping boxes. Boxes with sheets, boxes with storyboards, boxes with character designs, you know, model packs.
And how does that work? Do they take a picture of each sheet and then combine them together to create the motion, or how does that technically work? Do you know?
Well, the X sheets are exposure sheets, so that's like a big long, it's almost like a legal pad, but like probably, I don't know. If you imagine a legal pad blown up to be like tableau size, or they're much bigger. And that's where the animation directors, you know, are writing down the direction, you know, hold this character in this position for this, you know, this many frames, blah, blah, blah. He's giving all, or she, he or she are giving all the directions there. That goes with the storyboards. Storyboards are also fed into an animatic. And so you also have the visual reference, a moving reference that the director works on. And Steve was in there, and Derek was in there, and the director was in there, and, you know, the editor was in there, and they're finessing the animatic to go along with the X sheets, to go along with the direction that the animation directors are giving. So then that gets shipped over with you know, it's initially it's all black and white. So it's like you've got scripts, you've got X sheets, you've got the storyboards, you've got model packs. And then a couple of weeks later, I want to say it's like 2 to 4 weeks later, you get the color starts coming in. So that's when you get, you know, color backgrounds and the character, you know, the color call outs for the characters, color models for the characters. And and that's how it's kind of how it goes.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible because there's so many steps, so many layers that I know people kind of are aware of. But when you hear it explained like this, you realize the insanity of the role that a producer, for example, has to be organizing and coordinating all these things to make sure that they happen properly.
Yeah, and then the good thing is that it's not just, you know, because there is so much happening, usually there is a nice support structure there. So you have a line producer that's also, you know, I've had line producers working with me, and then production managers, and, you know, they take care of different departments, and then coordinators or assistant production managers that are working with them. You know, there's a nice support structure if you're working in a large studio usually. Mm-hmm. So that's very helpful to keep organized. There are so many people that go into making these shows, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just a big combined effort. It's funny.
Yeah. But it seems like your part of the work is requires a very broad knowledge of how things work. And then, of course, you have your specific strengths and things that you do and part of your job description, so to speak, the only way I can think about or put it is the producer is the one that helps get shit done, it seems like.
Yes, I think everybody helps get shit done. But I think,
of course, I know that you have to, you know, as a producer, you do have to be a little humble. But it seems like at the end of the day, like it always comes back to you. This person has to do their job, but and there are deliverables.
Yeah,
but you're the one that's saying, "Hey, we need to, bring this to the finish line."
Yeah, and I think that they're, you know, producers can be different of different types. I mean, there can be, you know, solely creative producers, or you can be, you get a producer title because you're a writer and you get, you know, a producer credit or a co-producer credit on it, but you're not in the day-to-day of the show. And that's one way. And then there's another way, you could be a line producer and you're, you know, physically involved in the show and driving the schedule and making sure that you're, you know, hitting the budget. And if there are problems, you raise the red flag, you know, the whole thing. That's more of a physical production. And then there are producers who are sort of the combination of, you know, creative, where, you know, you're involved as a partner with the director or the directors, and you are, you know, partnering also with the showrunner to make sure that you know, the vision gets done, right? It gets done to the level that everybody wants it done, and it looks a certain way, and it comes out a certain way, and you start piecing together creatively, this person is going to be like a great composer for this show, because the editor assembled the animatic with cues from this composer's previous movies, and it just sounds perfect. So how can I get that composer on this show? And then, you know, make a deal with his agent. And you just start piecing things together. And you're also, you know, involved in every screening, every, you know, review, every shot, you know, every you're looking at every shot. that's a different type of producer where you're more creative, but at the same time, you can, you know, drive the team in one way, or just sort of make sure, you know, it's a leadership role. That's what it is. You have to take on the role of a leader, which, you know, you can't just hold up your hands and say, I'm just creative, I don't get involved in that. You have to be able to get involved in that if you're going to be doing both. And that can get tricky too.
Yeah. There's a great definition for leadership by Ron Heifetz that I like, which is to mobilize people to overcome obstacles and come out on the other side triumphant. It sounds like that's what you're doing. You're trying to mobilize everybody who's involved to overcome whatever obstacles and bring this vision to life, and it coming to life and then making money is the triumph.
And you also, it's cool. And you know, there's an element to it because you have to also be the person you're the point person for the show, because sometimes the showrunner is on a different show or on a different project entirely. And you have to keep it going. And so you just have to carry out what you know is going to get approved, and what you know is in the nature of the show.
Yeah.
So, so it's different. It can be a combination of things, you know. And executive producers can be people who bring the money in. They can be people who, you know, are integral to getting the deal done. They can be a studio executive. They can also be somebody who is involved in the day-to-day of the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like there's like a spectrum. Each title has a spectrum, and everybody operates within that spectrum slightly different.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm curious, just staying back at Leica for a little bit, and somebody like Henry Selick, who clearly is a genius in his own right. Did you have a moment interacting with him where you noticed what his genius was, where you're like, oh, that's what makes this person unique and allows him to bring this vision to life? Do you have that?
Yeah, I think it's just his... he's very clear on what he wants. Again, it's the clarity of what he wants and the performances that he wants and from the animators and the look that he wants. So I remember, I remember him interacting with people and just being very clear where he wanted the camera, everything. I mean, he was just very clear on how he wanted the shots to look.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Knowing what you want is sounds very obvious, but it's not that obvious when you start to interact with people. You ask them questions and they're like, well, I hadn't thought about that. Well, that's what makes somebody that's very successful so good, is that they're well thought out. And that's something that you can just say quickly, but to think something through all the way, definitely takes some effort.
Yeah. And he, like I said, he's just one of those people who I think is he's very gifted in directing his movies and getting them done. You know, that's another thing. Just getting one of these things done is like a miracle. So
yeah, totally. It's like get shit done.
Yeah,
that is the miracle. Okay, so take me now to Disney. You go back to LA. Now you're with Disney. What are you working on there?
I started working on Tinkerbell. There was like the Fairies franchise, and there was a reboot of one of them. And I had initially gone to Disney Feature to see if I could possibly, you know, work there. There wasn't anything available. I mean, somebody called me from Disney Toon, which was a sort of another branch of Disney. It wasn't, they did sequels. They did spinoff sequels. So they did the Fairies franchise, and they were also doing Planes, which was a sort of a spinoff of the Cars franchise. Mm-hmm. But when I was there, they were just doing the Fairies franchise. And so I started working on a reboot with a director that I didn't know. I really didn't know. I knew like maybe one or two people there, but I really didn't know many people at Disney. And so it was a lot of new names, new terminology to learn. There's always like special studio lingo. You know, everybody has their own language in different studios. They call different departments different things. And you just have to learn like so on the fly from day one when you're coming in on a reboot, because the team's already there. They just want to get started on the new script with the new director and, you know, the new producer and let's get going. And so you're like, okay, I have to learn everybody's name really fast and what they do. And then I have to learn the whole studio and, you know, approvals and what's the hierarchy, what's sort of the culture in this place. So that was, I remember that first week, I was like, my brain was working really hard. But it was good. I mean, it was really good. And I enjoyed it. And we did that. We had a compressed schedule because we had to make up for time. We had a studio in India that we didn't want to lose. You know, we had contracted with them to produce this over a certain amount of time. And we don't want to lose that time with them. Like, you know, so we basically were hustling to get that done, and we did. And then after that, I worked on another Tinkerbell, and then another Tinkerbell. And then after that, I ended up working on developing what became Raya and the Last Dragon.
Mm. So
eventually that became Raya. Yeah.
Okay. And was Raya your last project there?
Yes, that was the last one. Yep. And then that division ended up, you know, it doesn't exist anymore, Disney Toon. So now, at that point, Warner Brothers, I ended up getting a call from Warner Brothers, and that's when.
Mm-hmm. So working with Disney or at Disney, what's the theme? Because now you've had Sony, you've had Leica, you've had Nickelodeon. What's Disney theme, and what's it like working there?
I was sort of amazed.
A loaded question.
I was pretty amazed at how big of a company Disney really was. I didn't really have that perspective until I was there. And then it hit me like, okay, there's Disney Toon, Disney Feature, Parks, there's Pixar. And creatively at that point, you know, we were answering to, you know, a creative leader who wasn't at Disney, but he was at Pixar. It was, you know, Lasseter. So it was a little bit different. It was, you know, we had to really figure out how to manage that. And yeah, it was just very different. There was a lot of support. There was a lot of, structure there in a way that didn't, you know, Leica was forming. It wasn't, you know, we were forming the entertainment branch of Leica. We were sort of creating that and hiring people to come up and attracting talent, and, you know, all of that. It was just very different. And then when I got to Disney, that was all already there. You know, you had a casting department, you had a, you know, music department. Everything was just so, I don't know, it just felt like it was very, structured. There was a structure to it.
Yeah. I mean, Disney is, I think it's worth $150 billion. So it's pretty big.
Pretty big. Pretty big.
Yeah. Okay. So that was like working for this big machine
Yeah.
Is Disney where dreams come true, or is it where you just work your ass off and try to make things happen because it's a big business that has to move forward?
I think it's probably it's a combination of both. I mean, because I think when you go to Disney, you have big dreams. And yeah. So, you know, I think that if you're on a show there in any capacity, you know, the big dream is to have that show be a huge success for them. The big company, big success. And I think that's, you know, so yeah, it's a combination of both, you know, big dreams and big company and, you know, big work ethic. You have to, you have to work hard. So.
Yeah, you have to work hard. Was Raya a pretty good success? Or how did Raya do?
I didn't stay with it. So, but I was happy to see it on the big screen.
The
nice thing is that it had a life beyond, you know, beyond what we did, which was good to see. You know, anything that keeps people employed and moving forward is really good. Was it, you know, I don't know. I honestly, it was something that it was bittersweet, you know, because I had wished that I had been able to be on it longer. But you know, things change, plans change, but I'm happy that it got made.
Mm-hmm. It seems like it's the theme of working in the entertainment industry and being a creative. Things change, and at this time now you're going to Warner Brothers, and what are you working on there, and for who?
That was Green Eggs and Ham, and that was a 2D series, and it was we produced it at Warner Brothers, and it was made for Netflix. So that was in 2015. That was the first time that I had worked with a streamer. And it was all new. Working at Warner Brothers is also different from working at Disney because they're just a different culture entirely, you know. And I had a lot of freedom again to sort of just start from scratch, really, because when I started, it was the creator was on it, and myself and his assistant. And the first thing I ended up doing was hiring a line producer, and you know, key people to sort of build out the team, and figure out how we were going to make this show, because they wanted 2D feature quality on an episodic, which is really, really hard to do. So to produce full animation for episodic is not easy. It's pretty unheard of. And I mean, people get close. It's kind of nice because I've been seeing, you know, some shows upping their quality, which has been really great. But I think that what we did was very challenging. It was very complicated and very challenging.
Yeah. And does your job become being somewhat of a connector or somebody who's mediating between Warner Brothers and Netflix? Or do you just focus on the show and that's it? And Warner Brothers is kind of the space where you're working.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you kind of bridge the two a little bit because you have to get, you know, Netflix to approve everything, but you also have to deliver to them, and delivering to them is a little bit more, at that time it was a little more complicated than I think what any of us had experienced, because again, it was a streamer, and I think most of the team, we had not delivered to a streamer, so, you know, figuring that process out was a little challenge. It wasn't hard. It was just different, you know. But it was, I, like, when it comes to you're sort of the hub between, in my job at that time was sort of the hub between everybody in a way. So that was, but it was fun. It was really fun. A lot of work. And we did two seasons.
I remember because I was I was talking to you every week. And that was a lot.
It was a lot. It was a lot. Especially, you know, when people start peeling off the show, or, you know, that was a different time when everybody was hiring left and right. And, you know, it was very hard to compete because, you know, their budgets to adhere to as well. And so it becomes hard when people are getting offered, you know, these great opportunities, and it's a little difficult to compete with that. But we figured it out and we got it done. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you wrapped that up. You were basically the last woman standing, so to speak.
I was even after it got delivered, it was, you know, there was still, you know, QCing to do and looking at some, you know, just some key art and stuff that went on the DVDs. I was the last one, and that was an experience, definitely.
I mean, you've had an amazing arc of in your career, and you've gone through a lot of transitions, and now you're in another transition. So we're probably gonna have to do kind of part two of this podcast to see what comes next. Yeah. So without teasing what's to come, I'm more curious now. There's two things that I want to know, and one may be a rabbit hole. And the other one may be something that you may have to think about a little bit. So which one do you want, the rabbit hole or the one that you have to think about a little bit?
Rabbit hole.
Okay. What's it like being a woman in the entertainment industry in a position like being a producer and being of Bolivian descent?
Sure. Well, I have to think about that, and it's a rabbit hole. I think things have changed for the better, gradually. I think back on it, and I remember very early on, I don't know if I ever told you this. There was somebody who I had really admired, and I thought he was, you know, very talented, and he was a director. And this is, you know, in the late 90s. And he had asked me about my family, and I told him, and he said, "Oh, so you're an anchor baby." And I had no idea what that meant. It went so far over my head because nobody had said that to me before. I'd been experienced all kinds of other stuff growing up, but nobody ever called me an anchor baby before. And so I just thought, yeah, I had to figure out what that was. And so that was, you know, that, like I said, things have changed since then.
Helen, tell us, what is an anchor baby?
When somebody comes from a different country, purposely has a child to take advantage of the system and claims, you know, the benefits of society because they had the baby in this country. Mm-hmm. And it's derogatory towards particularly Latinos. That's not my parents. That's not at all my parents. Mm-hmm. It's so offensive, like it's beyond. So I can't, yeah, it's really upsetting, and it makes me like feel, I don't know, I just feel like I'm getting all amped up, but So yeah, that was very, very upsetting to have that said to me. And I almost, I'm like, that would never happen now. Like that just, if it did, that person would be gone, you know, just completely gone, and potential, you know, bigger problems for the studio. But that, you know, that's like, it doesn't happen anymore, thank God. I don't think. I think also there's more sensitivity. I think women are given more responsibility now. I think there aren't as, you know, of course, there's room for growth. There's so many women that need to be put in place, positions of leadership and positions where they can, you know, direct a show, where, you know, we need more women as directors. We need more women as animators, more women as storyboard artists. Yes, that would be wonderful. But it is growing. I have seen definite change. So that's nice. Mm-hmm. It's getting better.
Mm. Well, I'm glad you're able to share this because these are things that people experience in different ways. And you experienced it through a comment like the Anchor Baby comment, which is a very ugly thing to say. But somehow you're still here and you're still working, and you've paved not only a way for yourself, but for others that may never know the path that
you've taken. Yeah, and I hope, I don't know if I paved a path, but I'm happy that I was able to stay on the path. And you know, one of the things that I would say made me really happy on Green Eggs and Ham was like into 2019, we had, the line producer told me, she said, we're at, you know, 50-50 gender parity on the show, which meant, you know, that was great. We didn't even really consciously, it wasn't like we were purposely trying for that. It happened naturally, which was even better because I would really, like, I'd love it if when this is not a thing that we talk about, you know, whether it's, you know, race or, you know, gender or any of that. It just is, it's not even an issue anymore. I think that'll be a great time. That'll be a great day. But it was really nice to achieve that at that time. And that was before the pandemic hit. So it was pretty nice to have that.
Yeah. Yeah, that must have felt pretty special. Well, that was the rabbit hole, and there's so much more we could unpack, and I'm sure you have plenty of stories. But I want to ask you the other question that may require a little bit of pondering or thinking, which is actually a simple question, but maybe challenging to answer, maybe not, which is, if there's one big lesson that you can take away from your experience as a producer working in the entertainment industry and doing what you do and what you've done, what's the lesson?
Sure. I think, there are so many lessons, but I would say I always go back to this to the beginning where I said, yes, I didn't know what I didn't know. And somehow I still said yes, because I really wanted it. And I didn't know how I was going to do it. I didn't I didn't have a mentor. I didn't know how I was going to do it. I didn't know anything. And when I look back at that, I'm like, yeah, to have that almost beginner's mind is so, it's such a gift, because you don't know. You don't know what you don't know, and it doesn't matter. So you just give it a shot, because you know what you want. You just don't know how you're going to get there. And so you just are saying yes. Mm-hmm. And it might be foolish, but I mean, I don't know. I almost think that had I really, really, you know, gone down, written it all out and, you know, talked to other people, gotten advice, gotten myself all worked up, I might have said no. I might have said, you know what, I don't think I can do it. I'm not going to move to LA and take this first job in a big studio, you know, at Universal, I probably would have thought twice, but I didn't. I mean, it was just, my instinct was just, yes,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Awesome. Well, I think that's it. Helen, this has been awesome. Thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
And it's. I feel like I just read this really cool autobiography about you. So that's cool. So thank you.
Oh, thanks, Carl. It's so good to see you. Thank you.
Yeah, same here. I appreciate it. And we'll do part two with what's to come.
What's to come, right.
That's
okay.
Right.
Okay, all right.
Awesome.
Thanks, Carl. All right, bye.
This is the Freestyle Way.